Okay, let's try that again. Can both of you attorneys hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay, good. We're going to do a little demonstration about how we keep time when we're doing oral arguments virtually. If you look at the upper left-hand screen, square of your screen, you'll see a green sign that's for start. When you have 5 minutes left to go, you'll see a yellow sign. It'll tell you 5 minutes. And when it's time to stop, you'll see a red sign that says stop. I will help you keep track of the red sign. However, if you are answering a question that a justice has posed, please finish your answer. I won't let you wander too far away from that answer when I tell you the time is up, but I do want you to be able to finish answering any question that has been posed when the red sign goes up. With those brief introductions, are you both ready to proceed?
Yes.
All right, very good. Attorney Arbach, I think you are our first attorney for the day, and I will now call our case, Monroe versus Chase. Attorney Arbach, please begin.
Thank you, and good morning, Chief Justice and Justices, and good morning, Counsel. I appreciate the opportunity to argue this case before this court for two separate reasons. First, it's always an honor to be able to appear in front of this court. But second, some time ago, there was a case, Cook versus Cook, and this court directed the attorneys for the parties in that case to brief whether or not the Court of Appeals is authorized to modify or overrule its own precedent. And I was ordered by this court to argue that they were not authorized to do so, which was ultimately the decision that was reached in that case. So rather than being able to modify or overrule its precedent, the Court of Appeals was given two choices or two options. One was to certify the case to this court for resolution, and the other was to apply its previous precedent, but to express within the body of its decision its disagreement with it. As you know, this case comes before this court via certification from the District 4 Court of Appeals, based on a concern that its decision in a case, Pronger versus Odell, was inconsistent with prior Supreme Court precedent. So I'm pleased to be here in part because it shows that that process of certification is working. We are here today to discuss the third element of six in malicious prosecution actions. Malicious prosecution actions are relatively rare. They require that an action be commenced against a defendant and that that action be resolved in favor of the defendant. There are many other elements as well, but that element, the resolution favorable to the defendant in the initial action, is what brings us here today. In 1940, this court decided the case of Lechner versus Ebenreiter. The citations are in the briefs. And the court discussed at length what it means to be successful. A dismissal of the underlying action was generally viewed as being successful for the defendant. The case was done. The Lechner court recognized three exceptions where, despite the case being dismissed, at the initial case being dismissed, no subsequent malicious prosecution action would be permitted. The first exception was when the dismissal was the result of an agreement between the parties, including the party who wished to bring a subsequent malicious prosecution action. A second exception was when the dismissal occurred as a matter of favor to the defendant in the initial action. And the third was when the trial court in the initial action did not reach the merits of the case as a result of some act, trick, or device. This case was primarily litigated on whether or not the voluntary dismissal, the unilateral voluntary dismissal by Chad Chase of the termination of parental rights action he had commenced against my client, Jane Monroe, satisfied that third element. It clearly was not a dismissal by agreement or stipulation. It was unilateral, and it was, frankly, last minute. A number of cases since Lechner, which was decided, as I said, in 1940, looked at those three exceptions and applied them, particularly whether or not a dismissal or resolution of the initial action occurred by agreement or by stipulation. And there is discussion about why that exception exists. It's been held that when a party enters into an agreement, stipulates, compromises, settles, that there's an implicit recognition that there was something there to settle. A party can't enter into an agreement, presumably obtaining some benefit from it, and then turn around after the dust settles and use the underlying action that was settled, compromised, as the springboard for a malicious prosecution action. It's been said that that essentially waives the party's right to argue later that it was a malicious prosecution. In 1985, so 45 years after Lechner, the Court of Appeals decided the case of Pronger versus Odell. Pronger versus Odell was a case in which a plaintiff sued her employer for sexual harassment in state court. The employer countersued for malicious prosecution, again, in state court. Not too long thereafter, the plaintiff dismissed her case in state court and refiled it in federal court. The Court of Appeals addressed that situation and refused to allow the malicious prosecution action to proceed for a number of reasons. One was it disapproved of counterclaims for malicious prosecution, since by definition, a counterclaim is asserted before the case has been finally resolved, and so you cannot allege that it was favorably resolved when it's not resolved at all. But second, they noted that the case hadn't been decided on its merits because it was still pending in federal court. Neither of those two determinations seemed particularly controversial. As a footnote, the Pronger Court of Appeals Court noted that stipulations or voluntary dismissals, rather, can never form the basis of a malicious prosecution action. When they said that, they left out the language dismissals by settlement or agreement of the parties that was found in Lechner and other cases. The sole legal support for eliminating that language or for that conclusion that that language without agreement or settlement of the parties represented the law of Wisconsin was their citation to the Tower case. The Tower case, cited in both parties' briefs, was a case where the court repeatedly emphasized that the settlement or the stipulation for dismissal was by stipulation or agreement of the parties. Put simply, the Tower case did not support the Pronger conclusion. Now, this case has an interesting history because the trial court was bound by that footnote I argued unsuccessfully that it was dicta, but the court applied it, saying all voluntary dismissals, not on the merits, cannot be used to premise a malicious prosecution action. The Court of Appeals then certified it to this court, recognizing, I suspect, that there was a conflict between that footnote and this court's decision in Lechner and others. That conflict is readily apparent. The Lechner case involved a case where the defendant in the original action entered into an agreement to turn over some certificates to their owner. The Lechner court was asked to dismiss the malicious prosecution action that he later filed based on that agreement, but declined to do so because it found that that agreement was not the kind of agreement barred by case law. It was not an agreement that implicitly admitted probable cause, because it simply admitted that he didn't have the right to those certificates, not that he had stolen them in the first place. Had the Tower footnote been the law of the land at that time, the Lechner cause of action had to have been dismissed, because there was a dismissal of the underlying case, not on the merits. But the Lechner decision affirmed a jury's determination that there was malicious prosecution and damages. The central question before us really is whether or not a malicious prosecution action can be brought, can be pursued, when there is a voluntary dismissal, a unilateral withdrawal, if you will, of the underlying cause of action. It is not whether that unilateral dismissal is always sufficient for a malicious prosecution action. It is whether the plaintiff in the malicious prosecution action can try to convince the fact finder that it reflects on the merits sufficiently to allow the case to proceed.
Attorney Alba,
can you
address what other jurisdictions who faced this issue, how they resolved it?
Yes. First, the restatement second of torts allows it to the plaintiff in a malicious prosecution action to proceed on the cause of action if there was a voluntary or unilateral dismissal, but requires the showing that it was reflective of the merits. Most states, the vast majority of states, have adopted that approach. There are nuances or variances among them. There are several states that have not adopted that approach and essentially have a blanket rule that if it wasn't a dismissal on the merits, you're done. The one case I'd like to emphasize is from our sister state of Illinois, which is the Cult Awareness Network versus Church of Scientology. That case was decided about 20 years ago. And prior to it, the case law in Illinois suggested an approach consistent with the Pronger footnote. That is, if it was dismissed, not on the merits, you were done. The Illinois Supreme Court looked at the situation and ruled otherwise. They looked at the public policy considerations. They analyzed their own case law and adopted the approach taken by the restatement of courts, the restatement of torts, excuse me. That court, the Cult Awareness Network court, stated, quote, "In our view, the restatement's position best balances the right of citizens to have free access to our courts and the right of the individual to be free from being hailed into court without reason, thereby better serving the interests of justice." Now, this court has clearly identified the first public policy consideration. In Johnson versus Collado, which is a 1991 case cited in at least respondent's brief, this court took a narrow view of malicious prosecution actions and looked at sort of which is the lesser of two evils, finding that there was a potential chilling effect or could be a chilling effect on litigants if they were threatened with a malicious prosecution action for every time an arguably meritorious case was brought and failed. But they recognized the need for a balance. The first thing I guess I would like to comment on regarding the public policy, which is really what this boils down to, is that the public policy of free access to the courts, of not being intimidated by the possibility of being countersued, if you will, that doesn't apply overmuch to the average litigant. Most litigants, or at least we hope, have a genuine good faith belief in the validity of their cause of action. Their motivation, or at least we hope, is a desire for a just result. So bear in mind that an action where a malicious prosecution could follow has to be one that was brought without probable cause and with actual malice towards the defendant in the initial action. So the persons who bring actions that one really can counterclaim against, really not counterclaim, subsequently sue for malicious prosecution, are the people that come to court with either frivolous or knowingly defective lawsuits, who are bringing these to damage the other party. There is a chilling effect, one would hope, that would work the other way. In other words, if a person knows you can bring a frivolous action without probable cause to harm somebody, but you face a potential malicious prosecution claim, the people that bring these kinds of actions may think twice, they think three times before bringing those kinds of actions. We, in our country, in our state, we don't hear a lot of people complaining that we don't have enough lawsuits. In fact, we hear the opposite. Nobody will complain if there is a reduction in abusive or frivolous lawsuits. They harm people, but they also harm the court system.
Counsel, if I were to buy your argument that the best choice is to use the restatement's approach to this question, is there then a need to remand the case to the circuit court for fact-finding about why the termination of parental rights action was dismissed in this case?
The procedural posture in the lower court was that the complaint was filed and the response was a motion to dismiss for failure to state a claim, which the trial court granted. So if the court reverses that and remands to the trial court, the next step in the litigation would be for the defendant to file an answer. Ultimately, whether that issue would be resolved by a motion for summary judgment or by a trial to the court or by a trial to the jury remains to be seen. But it would be an issue of proof. As the court knows, in order to prevail in a malicious prosecution action, the plaintiff must succeed in proving each of the six elements. And so if the matter was remanded, it would be my obligation to try to convince judge or jury that the outcome of the termination of parental rights action, that of dismissal, was in fact a success for the plaintiff in the malicious prosecution action.
So you see that element as having factual underpinnings, not underpinnings that would be made as a matter of law, correct?
In this particular case, yes. There are different types of dismissals where I could envision it being one of essentially where you could take judicial notice of the purpose. But in this particular case, it would create an issue of fact. And that's consistent with the approach taken by the restatement. Some courts have observed, and I think correctly, that people bring lawsuits and dismiss them for reasons other than a lack of merit. For example, sometimes people underestimate the cost of litigation. They run out of money, or their circumstances change where they're no longer able to retain counsel. And so they simply say, I can't do this anymore, and they dismiss their cases. In theory, you could have someone with a significant decline in health who can't face the pressure of a courtroom any further, so they withdraw the case. None of those kinds of withdrawals, which result in the dismissal, form the basis sufficient to bring a malicious prosecution action because they don't reflect on the merits. Similarly, this idea that the dismissal has to reflect on the merits is found in case after case after case. For example, if a judge dismisses the case because the cause of action was outside the applicable statute of limitations, courts do not view that as giving rise to a malicious prosecution response because it's not on the merits. If I allege that a person assaulted me, but I wait too long to bring the action and it's dismissed, it doesn't mean that I wasn't assaulted. It means that I wasn't assaulted in the applicable relevant time period. So that's not an outcome successful to me on the merits or to my accused. On the contrary, if a case is dismissed for failure to prosecute, or if it requires expert testimony and I fail to name an expert, there is an implication that is reflective, as they say, reflective of the merits. If I had a real case, I would be able to find an expert, or I would push my case along to trial. So the courts look at the different reasons given and the circumstances. In Shane's case, what we have is a situation where the dismissal, the voluntary dismissal or withdrawal of the petition for termination of parental rights, occurred a day or two before the scheduled hearing on the motion to dismiss and for sanctions for filing false pleadings. And so obviously we believe we could argue successfully to a jury that that was reflective of the merits, but it is a question of fact. I'm almost out of time, so let me just say that there's a strong public policy against rewarding people for doing tactical damage on purpose to people in our court system. If we assume the facts as true, and we have to at this procedural status, Chad Chase brought an action for termination of parental rights to take away someone's right to their children, knowing that the facts on which it was based were false. He did it so maliciously, and he kept that action pending for almost 9 months. He then, right before it was scheduled to be heard on the merits motion, withdraw the case. That shouldn't be tolerated. And the only remedy that one has in a position like Shane in a termination of parental rights action is this kind of a response. She'll never get time back with her kids. She can't recover attorney's fees in a TPR case. She can't recover for the emotional damage of having this hanging over her head by her formerly abusive ex-husband if this case is not allowed to proceed. She's not the only one in this kind of situation. People who are victimized by frivolous lawsuits spend fortunes defending themselves or go bankrupt, whether they're individuals or small businesses, it doesn't matter. We should require probable cause and essentially a lack of malice before allowing people to use our court system, essentially to weaponize our court systems against people they don't like. Thank you.
Thank you. Attorney Armstrong, are you prepared to begin?
Yes, I am.
Please
Thank
do.
You, Chief. Thank you. My name is Jean Armstrong. I am here on behalf of Chad Chase. May it please the court. We wish to say here that, contrary to Attorney Auerbach's statements, the underlying action here actually exemplifies why a blanket rule should be applied here in terms of not allowing a malicious prosecution action when there is a voluntary dismissal. The circuit court correctly dismissed Shane's complaint for malicious prosecution on the basis that Shane did not satisfy the third element required in the pleadings to survive a motion to dismiss, and that is that the facts alleged the former proceeding must have terminated in favor of the plaintiff. She stated the dismissal was not the result of any settlement or stipulation. Rather, it was Chad's unilateral decision to request dismissal. The dismissal here was not on the merits. Attorney Auerbach argues on behalf of Shane that this court should not rely upon that footnote in Pronger, but I respectfully submit that this court does not need to. The Pronger court, also states on page 296 that a cause of action for malicious prosecution requires that the underlying judicial proceeding must have, and I quote, begun with malice, without probable cause, and ends in failure, unquote. The TPR proceeding here did not end in failure, and I will get to that in a minute. In fact, it accomplished exactly what that Chapter 48 intends, but I will get to that in a minute. I will also say that Pronger cites Tower Special Facilities at page 228, after quoting the Lechner language that lists the ways in which a termination does not constitute a favorable termination. And the Tower case noted that there was, quote, no action and consideration by the court in the original proceeding, unquote. And that's true here too. This is what happened here. Chad's dismissal of the underlying proceeding was an act preventing consideration by the court. Now, Shane says the act must have been performed by the defendant in the initial action, but sometimes it's the defendant's own actions, here Shane's, that encourage dismissal. The TPR proceeding was based on section 48.415, sub 1, sub A, sub 3, sub B, as well as sub 6. For example, a TPR action such as this states that the defendant has abandoned the child. And so they bring the TPR action and allege the various grounds for that. But in a TPR action, there can be a stipulation. The parties can enter into a stipulation and an order to adjourn proceedings, for example. And that's what happened here. In that stipulation, the defendant in the TPR, here Shane, can agree to terms regarding the timing and the location of the placement and communication with the child. And then the defendant can follow through with the terms of the stipulation. And then it becomes difficult to argue anymore that the child has been abandoned. The petitioner in that case may not, under the new facts, i.e. the facts where the defendant is now not disregarding the child, not failing to communicate with the child, not failing to go see the child, but is actually complying with the stipulation,
Attorney Armstrong? It sounds to me like you're making a factual argument. And I think that Attorney Auerbach, in response to Chief Justice Rogenczak's question, admitted that this would need to be, what you're asking for needs to be determined by the circuit court. We're just talking about a general principle. You're asking us to say that never, never can a dismissal, a unilateral dismissal, be a basis for a malicious prosecution, to allow for the fact that anyone could bring a case against someone else, dismiss it whenever they want, and that's never going to be considered to be on the merits for purposes of malicious prosecution. So if you can speak to that more general principle, I don't think we're all potentially, at least Mr. Attorney Auerbach is saying, the merits of whether this particular dismissal was stipulated to or what the circumstances were are not in front of us right now. So can you speak to the larger principle of this very giant proposition that you're asking? And I guess I'll ask a more pointed question. How is what you're asking us for really align with the restatement, which is what we stated again in Lechner? How does that fit into the restatement language?
Thank you for your question, Justice Dallet. What I was trying to illustrate here is that my concern, and what should be this court's concern, that being subjected to a malicious prosecution action in, for example, the TPR case, would have a chilling effect on what a TPR plaintiff, for example, or plaintiffs in other cases, would, as far as dismissing it. For example, here, adopting Attorney Auerbach's position, in this example, the petitioner, or any TPR petitioner, or any plaintiff or party who where the reason for their action is no longer exists because it has been remedied, maybe because bringing the TPR action or any action that is of an injunctive relief nature need not be pursued. But here, if anyone who has an action, and then for whatever reasons, where the financial resources, lack of financial resources, for example, or resolution of the other underlying problem, as is the case here, if a party would not be able to dismiss the action for fear of becoming the defendant in a malicious prosecution action. So they're trapped between a rock and a hard place, essentially, because if they dismiss the TPR proceeding or any proceeding on grounds that, whatever the grounds are, they would be risking the malicious prosecution lawsuit. So if you follow the requirement that you have a specific finding of fact behind the reasons for dismissal, for example, then that means they can be hauled into court, right? So in this example, a plaintiff, a parent starts requesting placements and is complying with a stipulation, guidelines were established. We want the plaintiff, we want the petitioner to be able to dismiss the action, whatever the action is, rather than continuing on with their litigation. And so here, Wisconsin public policy is that we don't want to disincentivize plaintiffs for bringing an action, which the circuit court addressed too about bringing the action, we also don't want them to discourage, we don't want them to be discouraged from dismissing a case where appropriate. They as they could have a change of heart, for example, or but if that withdrawal means that the original plaintiff would face another lawsuit, a malicious prosecution lawsuit, then there's going to be a reluctance to dismiss their original proceeding. And that's why not all courts go along with having to do this specific fact-finding thing, because that requires going to trial, and that requires money, that requires expense. And
also before you get to the ability to file a malicious prosecution lawsuit, you have to be able to allege that, in this case, the TPR was filed without probable cause, filed based on actual malice. So I think the reason for the dismissal, at least as I read what has happened in this case so far, is that there seems to be a little bit of a conflict in the law, and it's for us to sort it out. But I don't think that we here today are going to be doing any kind of fact-finding on why he dismissed, when he dismissed, or why he brought it. That's all something that's going to get lodged back in the circuit court if opposing counsel prevails. If it doesn't and you prevail, of course, then the case is over here. But I think I tend to agree with Justice Dallet, is that your argument sounds like you're asking us to do fact-finding, but we don't do that. And I don't think Attorney Arbach has asked us to do that either. What he's asking is to clarify the law and send it back down to circuit court. I mean, maybe he'll lose at the circuit court if he's got to prove all that and he goes back.
Thank you. As a matter of public policy, however, there is a requirement that there be a some kind of finding relating to the merits of this action. That is the requirement. And in Lechner, of course, the prosecutor, they didn't pursue it. But in this case, I guess what I'm trying to say to this court is that it is important to have a blanket rule that that it has to be there has to be a dismissal somehow on the merits in order for there to be a malicious prosecution action, and that the requirement that it be on the merits is an important one. And I'm not suggesting that this court do the fact finding. What I'm suggesting is that no fact finding should be permitted here, because it will chill plaintiffs from dismissing their case, because for fear of being accused of having brought it wrongfully.
Counsel, the flip side of that, of course, is that the blanket rule you're advocating in this situation would allow a malicious prosecution, a malicious instigation of judicial proceedings. And so long as the person who brought it withdraws those, they are immune from this malicious prosecution claim. How would you address that counter argument?
Well, malicious prosecution actions are disfavored in Wisconsin. I would say that there is a, as the Brownsville court observed, there is a there's an abuse of process claim. And so it seems like what Attorney Auerbach is perhaps saying applies here is an abuse of process claim. And in fact, that tort was developed in order to provide a remedy in situations where malicious prosecution failed. And that's Brownsville versus Clawitter, 102 was second 108 at 113. But apparently here, it's not that there wouldn't be a remedy in instances like this, Your Honor. There would be, if they could go to an abusive process claim, and then they would not even have to worry about the third element here. The third element here is there for a reason, and the reason is for we don't want to have a malicious prosecution action reduce the public's willingness to resort to the court system for settlement of disputes. Was said by the Himmelfarb court in Tennessee, we declined to adopt a rule that would deter litigants with potentially valid claims from filing those claims because they're fearful of a subsequent malicious prosecution action. And nor do we wish to deter parties from dismissing their claims when a dismissal is the appropriate course of action. So by saying that a dismissal would require, you'd have to look at the specific circumstances under comment J, section 674 of the restatement second, that is saying they can be hauled into court. Whereas if there is a rule that says if it's not ended in some kind of way on the merits or some such thing, that it's just simply dismissed, then I think what we're looking at is that there is an exposure. You're right. I mean, a person can go into court and they can explain that they have good reasons for dismissal. They can go to the fact finder. They can have a trial. They can have summary judgment. But what petitioner or plaintiff in an underlying action would want to face that? Litigation is expensive. Litigation is hard emotionally. It expends judicial resources and financial resources of the parties. And so to say that it need not necessarily that any voluntary dismissal, you have to look at the specific facts of it. Well, if you have to look at the specific facts of the dismissal and why it was dismissed and all the underlying things, then that's a big risk, because then you're going to have to go to trial and you're going to have witnesses and you're going to have to argue what TPR plaintiff or any other plaintiff would have to think of when deciding whether to dismiss it for whatever reason they have. And there may be many reasons they would have to say, yep, but I'm going to have to potentially defend that in another case. So I might as well roll the dice and proceed with this case rather than expose myself to an accusation of malicious prosecution. That's why it has to be on the merits. Had Shane wanted to object to the dismissal, she could have. The complaint doesn't allege that she did anything other than acquiesce in the dismissal. And we want to encourage dismissal of cases when that's what the parties want. Here the parties obviously wanted it, but to say that that you'll always have to do this factual determination under the restatement, that's asking a lot, because then a plaintiff would have to, I mean, right now, the way our position is, the way the law is right now, voluntary dismissal is an action that prevents actor consideration by the court. And that's what happened here. So I think that that a plaintiff then in that position can say, all right, I'm going to dismiss this and I don't have to worry about a malicious prosecution action. Certainly, of course, if there's been an abusive process, they'll have to worry about that, but they don't need to worry.
Ms. Armstrong, isn't this in effect to prevent a lawsuit that is going to be filed for the purposes of harassment from ever being filed? And I think the problem I'm having with your argument is it seems to ignore the fact that just the simple filing of a case and the you know, every the hearings and the filings that happen at the beginning of the case, you're sort of ignoring the impact that might have on someone. So I just, I'm having a hard time. I'm having a hard time with that. Like, tell me, to me, the purpose of being able to bring a malicious prosecution case is to say, look, you harassed me. And now you're saying, well, you know, if a suit's filed and it is harassing, it doesn't really matter as long as it's dismissed. And it just, you're missing a big portion of that initial case. Can you speak to that?
Well, I think the assumption assumes that it, that there was sort of an abusive process in bringing the initial action. And if I'm understanding you correctly, you're talking about protecting someone from being sued in the instance of the underlying action. Is that what you're, do I understand you correctly?
There's two actions your argument.
I don't want to make sure.
Sure. No, I want to be clear. If I understand your argument, you're saying it's okay that someone files. Sure. It's okay that someone files a lawsuit that might be meritless or might be used to harass someone, whatever it is. What I'm hearing you say is, but don't worry about that. Don't look at this over here, because as long as they dismiss it over here, everything is fine and good. And I'm not understanding. I'm not understanding how I feel like you're just missing a huge impact that a case could have on someone if it is in fact filed maliciously. You're just saying, well, you can just, as long as you dismiss it, it's okay. And I feel like that ignores the impact that a case like filed like that could have on a party.
Yes, I agree that having a case like that can have an impact on someone. And I think that if someone does something like that and is wrongfully bringing a case, and like you said, for harassment, then there should be, someone should not be able to just dismiss it. But that is an abusive process claim then. Because what the situation you're discussing is where somebody is abusing the process by harassing somebody, bringing a lawsuit to make it difficult for them, and it can have an impact.
So then do we even need malicious prosecution if we have abusive process?
What abusive process is a remedy for people that cannot meet the all of the requirements of malicious prosecution, including a favorable a termination that's favorable to you. And I think that they address different things. I think that a malicious prosecution claim, not every malicious prosecution claim or not every abusive process, they have different elements in them. So I would say that in the abusive process, we have a willful act in the use of process not proper in the regular conduct of the proceedings. That's the first element. And then the other element was to obtain some collateral advantage attempt to use the process as a means of extortion, as an example, or carrying something in a way that misusing the process to do it. And whereas a malicious prosecution claim, you would need to, I think the reason why you have that and why it is so hard to meet all those requirements is so that somebody in the position that Chad is in here can dismiss it if they choose to.
Attorney Armstrong, I hear you arguing about public policy as the basis here for us to adopt what you're asking. Do you agree that if we agree with you and adopt this blanket rule that we would not be following the restatement, that we would be choosing to not follow it as a few states have done?
Right. Yes. You would not be following what is set forth in comment J. Right. Yes. And we would be in the minority position, as Johnson versus Collado said. We're in the minority position when it comes to the restatement there with the element of special damages. And the same is true here with the element of a favorable resolution. And I think that that's why the Wisconsin policy has been that we don't want to disincentivize plaintiffs from bringing an action or have the threat of malicious prosecution have a chilling effect on a litigant. And the concern here, especially, I think, is with respect to the voluntary dismissal that you would be exposed to another suit. Whereas if not following the restatement means that as a matter of law, if just by virtue of your having dismissed it, you're not opening yourself up to a malicious prosecution claim. So, here I submit that the circuit court was correct in the public policy reasons for having this blanket rule, that the evidence that we want to dispose of cases prior to trial and have rather than having all the parties go through a trial and drag things out. And the comment J of the restatement means that if it's followed, you do have to go through the trial and drag things out for fear of being hauled into court again. And if parties think that they can bring an action, the evidence has to reflect more than the proper use of the process was just a bad motive. For here, it has to be not warranted by the terms. And so if someone knew that, well, I'll quote from the circuit court here, if they knew that if they dismissed it voluntarily, they would still get sued for malicious prosecution, one of their thoughts might be, we will just roll the dice and see if we will survive this. So therefore, we're not going to dismiss it. And in the absence of a blanket rule, that is what would happen. So I think there's so the court, the circuit court, the Honorable Judge Bailey Reen said there is some public policy reasons for this language, saying as long as it's not tried on the merits and a favorable decision isn't granted in favor of the person who's now bringing the malicious prosecution matter, that's the only time you can bring the malicious prosecution matter because we want to support termination of proceedings regardless of how they are terminated, by settlement, by voluntary dismissal, by compromise, however. And so I think that discouraging voluntary dismissals when they're done under the law and within the parameters of Section 805.04, sub 1, that should be the rule, yes. So I think that if you look at Lechner and you look at Pronger and you look at the Pronger footnote and Tower, they are an act or consider some an action that prevents consideration by the court is a dismissal. And as such, I submit that this case does, or voluntary dismissals for that matter, do fit within those exceptions set forth by the Lechner court, that they do. I mean, obviously the Lechner requires certain things that would not be considered a favorable termination. And among those is an act or trick or device, but an act precluding consideration by the court. And that's exactly what happened here. And so I submit that Pronger is not inconsistent with Lechner. I also submit that Tower Special Facilities notes that in that case too, although the facts were different, that there was no action in consideration by the court. And the concern here is that if the bar is lowered for malicious prosecution action, so that a claim can proceed, and then there's a determination by a finder of fact that that she would, if there's determination by the finder of fact that would go far towards discouraging dismissals, because they would be open to having to go to trial or and further legal proceedings. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Are you prepared for a rebuttal, Attorney Auerbach?
I am.
Please begin.
Thank you. There's been some discussion about this case being an abuse of process claim. It is not. Abuse of process requires proof that the action was used for a collateral and coercive purpose to obtain an impact or a result that was not typical of the process. Here, we would have to have shown that the initiation of the termination of parental rights action was designed not to terminate my client's parental rights, but for some other collateral purpose. We don't believe that to be the case. The action was filed to terminate her parental rights. In fact, there was a companion petition for step-parent adoption that was filed contemporaneously with it. So we have no doubt that Chad Chase was trying to terminate Chase Monroe's parental rights. He was just doing it based on lies. But with the absence of some collateral and improper use of the process, an abuse of process claim doesn't lie. Second, I'm not denying in any way that there is a public policy that supports the minority approach. The courts have identified that. This court has recognized the public policy of not discouraging valid cases, valid litigants, or litigants with valid claims to come to court. We don't want to scare them off by the potential repercussions of losing. But it's a question of balance. And the approach taken by the Pronger note urged upon this court by Mr. Chase would destroy any balance that exists. We already have probable cause. We have to show a lack of it. We already have the issue of malice. We have to show actual malice. And as noted, we have to show that the plaintiff in the malicious prosecution action suffered special damages. This, in this state, unlike most, it is not enough to spend tens of thousands of dollars defending yourself from a frivolous lawsuit. It is not enough to miss work, to have to come to court, to wait for the trial, to have pretrial proceedings. None of that counts unless there's special damages on top of it, such as medical expenses or other. And that's because every litigant in legitimate cases or illegitimate cases spends money when they can afford it on attorneys, misses work, has to come to court, et cetera. So these aren't special damages. So, and then we have all of the elements that the plaintiff in a malicious prosecution action must prove. So the balance is pretty strongly stacked against people like Shane Monroe to begin with, making it impossible for her to proceed to try to recover any recompense for what she was put through is an unnecessary tilting of that balance out of whack. The argument has been made that a person like Chad Chase would be reluctant to dismiss his case if he thought it could lead to a malicious prosecution action. But I say that a person in his situation, knowing that there is no probable cause, coming flush up against a court hearing where that lack of probable cause is going to be, in all likelihood, recognized by the trial court, has every reason to dismiss the case under the restatement's approach. If the case had proceeded to a hearing and the judge had said, these affidavits that you filed in Minnesota that contradict your pleadings here in Wisconsin result in the case being dismissed, that would have been the kind of successful outcome that nobody could dispute. In other words, that would have cemented the third element. By dismissing the case, by essentially running away from it, abandoning it, he preserves his right to argue that he had a legitimate reason for doing so other than fear of the outcome. But also note that there are some things that are unique determinations of parental rights. I don't ask this court to rule separately for TPR cases, but nonetheless, they should be pointed out. 80504(1), the general provision provides that a court must dismiss a request for a dismissal once.
Counsel, you have to kind of conclude your thought.
I will. As it says in the brief, in a standard civil action, once the answer is filed, it takes a court order where the person seeking dismissal would have the opportunity to say, Judge, I can't afford this, or Judge, I'm too sick, or I've changed my mind, and get a court order based on that would preclude a malicious prosecution action. That's not available in TPR cases, but thank you.
Okay. And thank you both for a very interesting argument and quite an interesting case. We are going to adjourn now. The court will meet in closed conference at 1:30. We are adjourned.
Thank you.